The new developments in the Karen Reed murder trial.
This has been a wild turn of events.
I've seen a lot of things. I've never seen anything like this. This case never ceases to amaze me.
It's a spectacle, that's for sure.
It was a hung jury, so no verdict, no real ending to this case.
Karen Reed was back in court where a date was set for her to be tried once again.
There are a lot of issues in this case.
Proctor was improperly searching Karen Reed's cell phone for nude photos.
Michael Proctor, the lead investigator, relieved of his duties.
It's always the theories that each side will put forth for a jury to decide which one is more believable.
Karen Reed was drunk and angry and hit and killed John O'Keefe when she gunned it in the snowstorm.
Karen, did you ever say I hit him?
I did not.
There are more people here at the beginning of this than at the beginning of Johnny Depp's trial.
We're not concerned about any of the witnesses. None of the Commonwealth's witnesses are concerning us.
And once again, there was drama outside court.
There is a whole new set of legal troubles for Karen Reed. She is now facing a wrongful death lawsuit.
The lawsuit alleges that Karen Reed was drunk and reckless when she hit John O'Keefe.
It's not just Reed being sued here. The family also suing the two Canton bars from that night.
The two bars are liable for over-serving her.
The FBI is investigating an investigation of a murder. That never, ever happens.
At this point, multiple jurors have been reaching out to both sides, saying that they are certain Karen Reed is not a killer.
I did not kill John O'Keefe. I've never harmed a hair on John O'Keefe's head.
We're looking at arm injuries with scratches. We're not looking at tire tracks.
There are 17 jurors, and they are coming and going with a police escort.
The investigation wasn't thorough.
This can't be good for the prosecution moving forward.
I just hope justice is served for either one, whatever it is, you know?
The fate of her life is not in her hands anymore. It's not in the hands of her attorneys. It's not in the hands of the prosecutor. It's in the hands of the jury now.
591 Norfolk County residents were called to the courthouse. 10 days were spent questioning them, researching them, running their background checks, and ensuring that they could be fair and impartial when hearing the evidence presented in the second trial of Karen Reed. After 10 days and almost 600 potential jurors, we finally have a jury for the second trial. There are 18 total, 9 men and 9 women. There will only be 12 deliberating, and as of now, there are 6 alternates, though we may lose some along the way since the trial will be so long. So with the jury set and opening scheduled for next week, both the prosecution and the defense filed some last-minute motions, and both sides were in court this week with any outstanding issues, pleading their final arguments to Judge Beverly Cannone for decisions to be made. One of the motions that was discussed in the final hearing is taking another look at the Sallyport videos with the metadata. So here's the deal with this one. Now, we all know that the prosecution has been turning over random little clips here and there of Sallyport video, some before the last trial, some during the last trial, and some as recently as this year, which seems wild. But the defense obviously has some questions about this. Like, why are they getting random clips? Where's the rest of the footage? And why are some clips missing chunks of time? Some are grainy and dark, and some are inverted. So the defense decided that something's up, and they just wanted to see what's going on. So they arranged with prosecution and Canton Police Department to have an expert fly out to CPD to download whatever videos there are from the system in the original format. Now, they were hoping to get any metadata. Plus, having the files in the original format often gives much better quality files, so maybe they could actually see something. But when the expert got there, the Canton police and Colleen Crawford from Norfolk DA's office and Chief Rafferty basically were like, yeah, there's not anything on the DVR because it overwrites after 30 days, and they wouldn't allow the expert to make any copies of the other system, which we would later hear is where the videos were apparently actually stored. So this causes a big stink, at which point Brennan says he starts to look into it. So here's where things get fishy again. Now, it seems like, according to what has been filed and what has been said in court, that Brennan was telling the defense one thing in their discussions and saying a different thing in court filings or in writing. Now, because this has kind of dragged on, I think that what's really happening here is getting lost. So I want to break this down a little bit. Now, in court documents from January 29th, Brennan said that he spoke to retired Sergeant D.G. Impetro with Canton PD, who told him that he would routinely preserve a copy of the videos on the department's work server slash hard drive, which is separate from the DVR that overwrites after 30 days. Okay, so officially, Brennan has said work server slash hard drive, but here's the problem. Apparently, what Brennan was telling the defense was something totally different. Although he called it a work server or hard drive in the court documents, Alan Jackson says that Brennan told them that the retired sergeant was storing the videos on an iCloud account.
He said that the detective believed that he kept a copy of the January 29 video that we were looking for, and that he said that it was on a work computer's iCloud account. Mr. Brennan said that they intended to download it from the iCloud, turn it over, and that's the point at which we said, if you don't mind, just hold off on that because we're litigating ultimately this issue.
Okay, so here's the reason that this distinction matters. If the video files have been put into some retired sergeant's iCloud account, they are likely no longer attached to that metadata, and they are no longer in their original forensically sound format. But if they were saved onto the Canton Police Department's hard drive, that's different. So the first time that we, the public, hear about this iCloud account is at the hearing on February 6th when Jackson brings it up.
The Commonwealth has since told us, Mr. Brennan told us, that remarkably he went to Canton PD, and this is in his opposition paperwork and his declaration, and he spoke with some officer. And that officer told him that he, the officer, personally made a copy of the entire January 29th video footage and placed that copy in some sort of an iCloud account. Not on the DVR system, not in the official data bank in which it's supposed to be stored, but on some iCloud account.
So I thought maybe this was just some type of confusion or misstatement from Jackson, but the defense will also reference the conversation about saving to the cloud in court documents and again in another hearing a couple weeks later. And when Brennan gets up during this hearing to discuss what happened, he doesn't deny telling the defense that it was an iCloud account. Although this time, when he mentions it, he is more vague about how he references where the videos were saved, this time calling it a file that the sergeant noted as a detective file or on his hard drive.
He told me in conversation that he would routinely store a copy on a file he noted as a detective file or on his hard drive.
So in talking with the defense team, Brennan talks about these files being stored on the sergeant's iCloud account, on the retired sergeant's work computer, and this detective file. But there's no mention of any files being on the official department video system. Jackson even pointed out that in the hearing, because it was something that the defense wasn't happy about, that all of these files were saved so informally. So after that hearing on February 6th, the attorneys got together from both sides and agreed that someone from the prosecution will download the videos from the iCloud account and they will record it on video for the defense. Problem solved, right? Well, no, because the day after the attorneys came to this agreement, Attorney McLaughlin from the prosecution team sends an email to the defense, and she says something totally different than what Brennan has been saying to them.
After we reached this agreement that the iCloud would just be downloaded and videoed, we receive an email from Ms. McLaughlin, and that changed the parameters of what we had believed and what we'd been told by Mr. Brennan, and it sounded more like this. The Commonwealth changed the story from some work computer iCloud account to the footage was being stored on what's called the, quote, department's video file system. It's very different than a retired officer's or a retired detective's work computer's iCloud.
So the defense gets this email and they're like, wait a minute. So these are files on the official video file system or CPD computer? That's not what they were told or led to believe. So that changes everything for them. The agreement about just recording the download of these videos was when they were told it was being recorded from an iCloud account. If this is the actual official system for Canton PD, then there is likely still forensically sound files on there, which is what they've been wanting. So the defense responds, asking the Commonwealth to have their expert conduct a full forensic image so that they can get the metadata and the file logs and any deleted data that may be recovered from the computer. This is what they've been asking for and what they were wanting their expert to have access to in the first place. But Brennan responds, saying that they would not be obtaining a forensic copy. So the defense says, okay, well, please ensure that all of the metadata and associated logs that are attached to the files are copied onto a thumb drive. Brennan responds again, saying no, and telling the defense that they would need to file a motion with the court for that. So they do, the very next day. And in their motion, the defense asked the judge to intervene. Otherwise, they say the prosecutors will be allowed to destroy critical metadata that they've been asking for. So Brennan files a response, saying that the defense is just trying to complicate this process. Now, he says he is going to click and drag copies of any stored videos to a hard drive and give that to the defense. So a couple weeks later, they're back in court arguing this situation to the judge, and Judge Cannone ends up denying the defense's request to intervene. And her reason is that the defense didn't give an affidavit or any expert opinion that this whole drag and drop thing that Brennan is mentioning would in fact destroy the metadata. So that's on February 24th that the judge issues her ruling on this. Over and done, right? But 3 days later, now that the decision is already made and they've gone through the litigation on this already, the retired sergeant creates a report that details the chronology and how he handled the video files and evidence. Now, this report is then given to the defense the following day. It's Friday afternoon around 3:30 on February 28th, and the defense sees in this report for the very first time that the sergeant was responsible for downloading all of the video surveillance footage from this case, and he downloaded videos into what he referred to as the detective drive. Nothing about an iCloud account or personal work computer. The defense is once again looking at this like, okay, Brennan has been in touch with this sergeant for months, so why didn't he relay this information to the defense sooner, prior to litigating these issues? So with this new information, the defense files a motion asking the judge again to reconsider, and they include the affidavit from an expert that says, yes, the drag and drop method will result in the destruction of relevant metadata that is critical and necessary to verify the authenticity of the video surveillance footage. And the only reason that the defense even agreed to let them do that in the first place was because they were misinformed about where these files were coming from. So now this issue is back in front of Judge Cannone again, and defense attorney Liza Little is arguing it. Now, Ms. Little says that after they got this new information and filed the motion for the judge to reconsider, and they included the affidavit with the expert saying, hey, this drag and drop thing will destroy the metadata, it was the very next day that the prosecution went ahead and just did the drag and drop anyway.
We have since provided the court with an affidavit from our expert establishing that if the Commonwealth engaged in the protocol that they proposed, namely simply dragging and dropping files from the Canton Police Department computer onto a USB drive, then all of the associated metadata would either be destroyed or otherwise unverifiable. And of course, right after we filed that affidavit, the very next morning, the Commonwealth went ahead and dragged and dropped the files from the Canton Police Department computer over to a USB drive.
So are we surprised? No. So Ms. Little says that the damage has been done on that, but they just want a chance for their expert to go image the files that are there so that they can see if there's anything on the computer that they can actually get the metadata for. Brennan responds and he says that he has invited the defense to come to Canton PD and download what is there, and the invitation stands. What he doesn't mention, however, is that they already did that, and nobody would let them access anything other than the system that had already overwritten everything. So Brennan says that the defense can come and they can't image the entire file, but they can get whatever is related specifically to this case. So the judge's ruling on this, she says, allowed in part and denied in part. She says that Brennan has agreed to let the defense expert download the file pertaining to this case, but They can't download the entire file. We'll be right back after this. One other outstanding motion they addressed was the jury view of 34 Fairview Road and Karen's SUV. Now, they did it at the last trial, and they want to do it the same way this time, except Karen is going to be there also. So they didn't spend much time on this one. Most of it was agreed on, but there was one part that I thought was really funny. Now, the first time that this was brought up in court, Hank Brennan objected to Karen's SUV being there, and here's his reasoning.
But I do not think the vehicle should be at 34 Fairview. It's not going to replicate the circumstances of that evening, and so it creates an image that is inaccurate. So I do not think that the vehicle should be sitting in front of that home in totally different lighting conditions, timing conditions, and I think it can be misleading.
And here's Brennan's reasoning this time around.
The only issue that was of difference was whether or not the motor vehicle would be at the address. The only reason I had reluctance, I thought it was unfairly prejudicial to the defense. If they decide,
they want it, right? You want the vehicle there at the time?
We do.
If they want it there, then I'll be agreeable.
Okay.
That was my concern at the time, but if that's that request, okay. I'll agree to it.
Okay. Now, y'all tell me where he said anything in that first clip about being concerned for prejudice against the defendant. Actually, tell me any time where he said anything ever about being concerned for prejudice against her. Sometimes I wonder if he even believes his own mess. There are also some final decisions that have been made about the dog experts on each side, so I want to go over those. Now, as a reminder, in the last trial, Judge Cannone made a ruling that a biomechanical engineer, who was a PhD, could not give an opinion on the cause of injuries. She said specifically that only a medical doctor could do that. So that was the ruling, and that's what the defense has kind of been rocking with for the past year. So fast forward to last month, and the prosecution has brought in this dog behavior specialist with a PhD named Dr. Crosby, who they say is going to tell the jury his opinion that the injuries on John's arm did not come from a dog. Now, most of us who followed this case closely didn't really spend much time on this because we all just kind of assumed that Judge Cannone would limit that part of the testimony since she's already ruled on that specific issue before. But much to our surprise, Judge Cannone allowed it. She said, that's fine, he can give his opinion on this, even though he's not a medical doctor. So this obviously changes things. The defense is looking at this ruling and realize that since now the judge is allowing this, that opens them up to bring in their own dog expert, Lieutenant Garrett Wing, who is going to give the opinion that the injuries on John's arm did come from a dog. So once again, here we are with the battle of the experts. Now, Brennan wants to keep Lieutenant Wing from testifying, saying that he isn't qualified to give expert opinion on this. Ironically, he says that Wing has no training with pattern recognition. Now, the reason this is ironic is because when defense expert Dr. Marie Russell talked about pattern recognition, Brennan said this.
So your testimony is, if I look at everything together, I can have an opinion. If I look at this separately, it means nothing.
If I look at it separately, I cannot be as definitive, correct?
Well, not as definitive. I'm asking you for an opinion. You don't have any evidence that this has any relation to a dog bite. Without looking at the whole arm and giving that general opinion we'll get to, you have nothing.
So, Brennan doesn't want defense's dog expert, Garrett Wing, to testify. He tried to keep him out before, and the judge denied his request, so he renewed his request and has now asked again to exclude Lieutenant Wing, and the judge just denied the request again. Now, Judge Cannone says that Lieutenant Wing appears to be qualified by experience to provide some help to the jury on some issues in dispute. But if Brennan wants him out, he can renew his motion before Wing takes the stand, and if it's needed, they can do a limited voir dire at that time. So they move on to the prosecution's dog expert, Dr. Crosby. So Dr. Crosby is going to say the opposite of Lieutenant Wing. He thinks that the injuries are not from a dog. Now, the defense filed a motion to exclude Dr. Crosby for various reasons, which we've gone over before, including his report having a bunch of stuff that's inadmissible. But Judge Cannone denied that request and is allowing Dr. Crosby to testify. So the defense renewed their motion, and the judge denied it again, but did place some limitations on Dr. Crosby's testimony. Now, Brennan claims that there's definitive evidence to clearly show Chloe was not the cause of the wounds on John's arm. He says that there were molds done of Chloe's mouth, and the spacing of teeth is distinguishable between the molds and the injuries on John's arm. And he wants Dr. Crosby to tell the jury that it could not have been Chloe because they compared the arm wound pictures to the mold of Chloe's mouth. Now, the National Academy of Science report shows that you can't really exclude any specific dog based on any kind of reliable science. So Judge Cannone said that Dr. Crosby is not allowed to tell the jury that his bite mark analysis excluded Chloe as the cause of the injuries. I don't think Brennan was satisfied with that, but bite comparison has been called junk science and has been heavily debated based on multiple wrong convictions that used it as evidence in those trials. So I think it's the right decision on this one. There were also a few new motions added to the docket this week, including one from journalist Gretchen Voss and one from Aidan Carney, aka Turtle Boy, both of which did independent coverage of the first trial. Now, Voss did an interview with Karen Reed for Boston Magazine, and she's been on the witness list for this trial. Witnesses are subject to a sequestration order, meaning she wouldn't be allowed to be in the courtroom or cover the trial as a journalist because she wouldn't be allowed to watch it until after she is called to testify. However, both sides have agreed that they won't be calling her, so Voss has asked to be released from the sequestration order. There was no opposition to this one, so it shouldn't be an issue. Now, as for Turtle Boy, that one had some opposition, and they addressed it at the hearing this week. Now, we talked about the motion last week that he filed to be exempt from the sequestration order, so I won't spend time going back over that, but I do want to address the hearing where they discussed it. Brennan says that he does want Carney sequestered, and he says he plans to call him if he needs to, depending on third-party culprit evidence that may come in, or possibly for rebuttal, meaning Turtle Boy wouldn't be released from the sequestration until closing arguments. Now, Carney's attorney, Tim Bradle, was in court to argue the motion, and he said that if Carney is called as a witness, he's going to invoke his Fifth Amendment right, which, legal system 101, if you have pending charges, it would be crazy to testify in another case where the prosecutor is planning to question you about communications that they say are related to the exact subject matter of your own charges. There's not an attorney alive who would say, yeah, go ahead, that's a great idea. Plus, if he didn't invoke his Fifth Amendment right, that means that they could call him as a witness and he wouldn't be able to cover the case. And he said in his motion that this is his job. So, Brennan says if Turtle Boy invokes his Fifth Amendment right, there's no realistic likelihood that they will call him as a witness. So, Turtle Boy's attorney, Tim Bradle, says he can speak on behalf of his client who was in the courtroom at the time and invoke the Fifth Amendment right for him. But Brennan says no, not so fast. He wants Carney to do it himself on the record. So, Carney goes up to sidebar with the judge and his attorney. He invokes his Fifth Amendment right, and now Turtle Boy will be allowed in the courtroom to cover the case. But just like in the last trial, when the witnesses who are listed in his pending charges of alleged witness intimidation are testifying, he is not allowed inside. There were also a few other decisions made. For example, the defense will be allowed to give the internal affairs findings for former Trooper Proctor and Trooper Buchanick and Trooper Tully, although there's still some disagreement about the internal affairs investigation findings for Kevin Albert being allowed in. Also, the prosecution is asked to have a third party come in to read the text between Karen Reed and John O'Keefe. Now, last year, this was done by Trooper Guarino, since he's the one who did the extraction, so they were a part of his testimony. The defense is opposed to having somebody come in and read these, saying that this could lend itself to some sort of theatrical presentation. And they're concerned about having someone reading text conversationally, like putting emphasis on certain words or inflection or tone that could give the wrong idea. I'm not really sure how I feel about this one. It's not the normal practice. And given Brennan's history with theatrics, I can understand the defense's concern. But there are a lot of issues with troopers in this case, so I can imagine that Brennan may not want a trooper reading them, since the jury's not going to like a lot of what is said about some of these troopers. So we'll see what the ruling is on this one. And finally, the issue that never seems to get resolved, ARCA. So here's the deal with the ongoing ARCA argument, because there are multiple parts to this. Now, Brennan says that he is still unsatisfied with the discovery produced so far when it comes to ARCA, and he wants limitations on their testimony and what is allowed because of the reciprocal discovery, meaning he doesn't have all the information that he keeps saying he wants, and he wants the judge to limit or exclude ARCA from testifying. Now, we've been over the ARCA timeline before, so I'm not going to get too in the weeds going over it all again, but here's the Cliff's Notes version for those who are new to the case. The U.S. Attorney's Office started looking into the Norfolk DA's office investigation into the death of Officer O'Keefe. So they're not going to go to the DA's office and say, hey, we're investigating your investigation. Can you give me all of your case file? So a subpoena was sent to defense attorney David Yannetti in September of 2022, who then turned over everything that was given to him from the DA's office. And that subpoena was ongoing, so they continued to give over all of the new discovery. So the U.S. Attorney's Office and the FBI had access to all of the information and evidence and discovery, and they acted as the gatekeepers to ARCA. They decided what information to give them that would be relevant to the scope of what they were hiring ARCA to determine. Specifically, if the car damage to Karen's SUV could have come from hitting John O'Keefe, and if the injuries of John O'Keefe could have come from being hit by Karen's car. Now, this was all done with the defense and prosecution knowing nothing about it. This was completely independent from each of them. Now, there were limitations on discovery that we've been over in depth, specifically because of ARCA being hired by the feds. But now, the federal investigation is over, which changes a few things and has raised some of the issues that Brennan is now really angry about. The prosecution has hired their own set of crash daddies, including a biomechanical engineer named Dr. Welcher, who is going to give the opposite opinion of the ARCA experts, saying that the car damage and injuries are consistent with each other. So here's where this timeline becomes really important here. The federal investigation has just recently ended, right? We've covered that. So after it ended, the U.S. Attorney's Office told the prosecution and defense that they were now allowed to retain ARCA as a witness if they wanted to, like if they wanted to have them do any additional testing, since the scope of their testing was limited, and the U.S. Attorney's Office was the one in charge of deciding what evidence ARCA used to come to their conclusions. So they're basically like, hey, if either of y'all want to have them do more testing or want them to do that testing with different evidence, go for it. So as soon as the defense finds out that they are allowed to hire ARCA, they hire them. And now, since they're no longer limited by the federal government, the defense sends ARCA the reports from the prosecution's expert, Dr. Welcher, along with all of the specific materials that Dr. Welcher had in order to come to his conclusions. Now, this is very common with experts. Let your expert know what the other expert is saying and why. It helps with cross-examination and can just give a better and more prepared testimony. It's very common. So Jackson says that he expects to have a report or information from ARCA about this stuff that they gave him, Dr. Welcher, within about a week to 10 days. And he says as soon as he gets it, the same day, he will turn it over to the prosecution. But Brennan is really upset about this because he says that the deadlines have passed and it's too late to be bringing in new testing and discovery.
This is the very issue I've been concerned about since the beginning of this case. And I've made every effort to alert the court that I had a concern, in fact, that I anticipated this very thing would happen. When I began this case, beginning of October, end of September, my first analysis was of the past history of this case and dropping experts and information during trial. My attempt was never to preclude ARCA from testifying, never. But it was to preclude the defense from trying this case by ambush. And it was my primary concern. And that is why I filed motions from the beginning of this case. Your Honor must remember, I was filing notices of intention, notices anticipating, things that are not routine because I knew this very thing would happen. We had ARCA witnesses where I still do not believe we have had full disclosure.
regardless of whose fault it is, I still do not believe we have full disclosure. Not just for the basis of opinion, but regarding communications between the defense and ARCA. That's why I filed this motion for discovery. And when the defense responds, it's not in their possession of control, that's why these ARCA witnesses, who've made representations to this court about not knowing the defense and the limited interaction with the defense, they need to be held accountable. That information should come directly from the ARCA witnesses if the defense can't or won't produce it. I believe there will be information that ARCA has if you order them to bring in all of their communications, email, phone call records, billing, and text messages. And if it exists, I would like to see it. I think I'm entitled.
So there are two issues here. One is that Brennan basically says he thinks the defense is lying about having turned over all of the communications that they had with ARCA, and he wants the phone records and the text and everything directly from ARCA because he doesn't believe the defense. And he even seems to imply that ARCA was lying because he says that they made representations to the court and need to be held accountable. Yikes. Now, the second issue is Brennan is furious, as in pounding the podium and snarling as he's giving his sermon or argument or whatever you would call this, because he can't believe that the defense would try to pull this stunt last minute when they've had since November. He keeps saying November. Okay, here's the thing, buddy. Let's be realistic about the timeline and quit with the misrepresentations. Brennan seems like he's trying to convince the court and the public that the defense is trying to pull a fast one on them. And he's been warning everyone about this coming. But that's not based on fact, which Alan Jackson points out.
Your Honor, what appears to be feigned indignation is just not consistent with the facts. We didn't receive Judd Welcher's report until basically February 2025. Nobody's been dragging their feet. There is no ambush. This feigned indignation is just not consistent with the facts, Your Honor. The court hadn't ruled that we could even use ARCA until just a few weeks ago. We've been moving expeditiously to try to rebut a witness that the Commonwealth disclosed in February of 2025. By mid-March, asked for a TUI request. We asked for a TUI permission, or asked permission to engage them through a TUI request. That does take time. We did it expeditiously. We weren't waiting for some advantage. As soon as we got the request approved, we immediately, that day, engaged them, and immediately that same day, provided the Commonwealth notice that we had engaged them and we intend to use them to, at the very least, to address Judd Welcher's testimony or his reports, the last iteration of which we got on March 24th.
So here's what's really been happening. Brennan waited until the deadline to turn over all of his expert testimony. Okay, that's fine. Including the report from Dr. Welcher. Now, it wasn't until February 1st that the defense got the report, which was turned in the day before. And a few days after that, they got the rest of the information to the defense. Now, that was February 5th. Now, 2 days later, the defense sent the TUI letter to the feds, hoping to be able to hire ARCA, since they're calling them as a witness. They wanted them to be able to rebut the testimony of the prosecution's expert, this information that they just got a couple days before. Now, this happens in literally every trial. The defense will find an expert that goes against the prosecution's expert and vice versa. So, of course, the defense wants their expert to be prepared with the prosecution's expert information. This is a little bit different, of course, because instead of being able to just hand it over, now they have to go through the feds to get permission for this. So they send the letter to the feds within just days of receiving the information from the prosecution. Now, the final report from the prosecution's expert, Dr. Welcher, which had some adjustments from the first, was turned over to the defense on March 24th. On March 26th, just 2 days later, the defense hears back and they are allowed to hire ARCA. That same day, they hire ARCA, send ARCA Dr. Welcher's report and information, and then notify the prosecution that they are hiring ARCA for this purpose. It's disingenuous for Brennan to act outraged that this is happening, especially when he keeps misrepresenting the dates. He turned over a CV, or curriculum vitae, of his expert in November. That's basically just a resume. That's irrelevant here. It's his report and opinions and what that's based on that matters in this situation. Also, the prosecution is literally still turning in evidence past the discovery deadlines. So to pretend to be offended that the defense is wanting to turn in a report that rebuts your expert, it's just ridiculous. The hypocrisy of it all is just infuriating to me. And I imagine it's only going to get worse throughout the trial. So the judge did rule on this. Judge Cannone has ordered that the defense must turn over all additional discovery from ARCA by Friday and disclose any kind of oral agreements or understandings about reimbursements or payments between ARCA and the defense. I think that's very fair. Also, the judge ordered that by April 21st at noon, the defense must disclose to the prosecution any testing that has been done or asked for, or any testing that's currently happening, as well as any results from testing, and when any testing or results will be completed. Brennan keeps repeating that he doesn't want to exclude ARCA, but he keeps going down different avenues to try to do just that. So we'll see how this plays out. Now, the rest of the issues were minor and seem to have been worked out or agreed upon by both sides. So seems like we're finally getting all of these issues wrapped up. Now, there's no court on Monday since Massachusetts recognizes Patriots Day as a court holiday. And opening statements are scheduled to begin on Tuesday morning. Now, this is shaping up to be a very different trial than the first one. And I can only imagine how much more intense it will get as we go. I'll be streaming it live every day on the new YouTube channel, Crime Junkie Jury. So join me live as we watch together, chat about it, and react in real time. Enjoy the next few days, because next week, our official duty as 13th jurors begins again. My name is Brandi Churchwell, creator of 13th Juror Podcast. If you're enjoying it, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and share this episode with your friends. For more information, photos, and episode guides, visit our website at 13thjurorpodcast.com.